America versus Vargas. Ms. House? Mr. House, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Chief Judge Richmond, and may it please the court. Your Honors, for decades under Stinson versus United States, the doctrine we lawyers know as Seminole Rock or our deference has applied in the exact same way to the Sentencing Commission's guidelines commentary as it is applied to all other agency rule interpretations. 4 years ago, in Kaiser versus Wilkie, the Supreme Court decided that Seminole Rock deference should still be a thing, but it severely narrowed that doctrine. What the court told us and what it made clear was that a federal court is not to defer to what an agency says its regulation means unless it finds that regulatory text genuinely ambiguous after using all the ordinary tools of interpretation. So that brings us to this case. The primary question before the full court is whether what Kaiser had to say about Seminole Rock deference applies to the guidelines commentary. Both parties before you today agree that the answer is yes. Stinson affirmatively held that Seminole Rock deference applies to the commentary. Kaiser clarified that there can be no Seminole Rock deference without genuine ambiguity. So, of course, the same limitation governs the same doctrine's continued application to the commentary. Four courts of appeals, including two sitting en banc, have reached that straightforward conclusion. We're simply asking this court to join them in holding that after Kaiser, courts are not bound to commentary that expands the substantive reach of unambiguous guideline text. And when it comes to Mr. Vargas, my client, that clear rule also happens to dictate the answer to the second question presented. The text of Guideline Section 4B1.2B is not ambiguous. It sets out an exhaustive list of qualifying controlled substance offenses. Conspiracies and attempts are not on that list. That means the commentary purporting to add those two inchoate offenses isn't entitled to deference, and it means Mr. Vargas's conspiracy convictions shouldn't have triggered the career offender enhancement. But here too, the court doesn't need to take Mr. Vargas's word for it. Five of this court's fellow circuits, including here three sitting en banc, have looked at Section 4B1.2B's text and concluded that its plain language unambiguously excludes conspiracies and attempts. And three of those circuits have expressly rejected the government's request to add attempts and conspiracies into the guideline through a secondary meaning of the term prohibits. Now, there are a bunch of problems with that reading, but for now, I'll simply emphasize the fundamental flaw that led the en banc 11th Circuit, found most compelling just last week in rejecting this very argument in United States versus Dupree. Even if the court could read this text to reach any offense that tends to hinder the listed elements in an abstract sense, there is no intellectually defensible way to limit that reading to attempts and conspiracies without also sweeping in numerous other unlisted offenses. The government's logic would readily extend the guidelines coverage to possession of drugs, solicitation of drugs, as well as more attenuated crimes like money laundering. But the Supreme Court already rejected that boundless reading in Salinas versus United States when it told us that this guideline's plain text, the very text we're looking at today, purposefully excludes mere possession offenses. And that, of course, only reinforces our contention that the exclusion of inchoate offenses is just as purposeful. So in short, this is one of those cases where the most obvious answers are also the right ones. Stinson held Seminole Rock applies to the commentary, so Kaiser's clarification does too. And Section 4B1.2 on its face doesn't reach conspiracy offenses, So the commentary that would alter that gets no deference. And with that, I would very much welcome the court's questions. If we don't have any, I will move.
Oh, no, I have a question.
Nice try.
Counsel, in performing the Kaiser analysis, we're instructed to consider not only the text, but also the history and the purpose of the provision. Now, as I understand it, the history of this provision unambiguously included in code offenses in the earlier iterations, included not only the substantive offenses, but also similar offenses. And so aren't we bound to take into account that history in understanding whether the current provision also includes inchoate offenses? And I ask because I don't see, with all the greatest respect in the world to our sister en banc circuits, I don't see them even mentioning the history of the provision.
Well, Judge Duncan, there's a couple points to make about the history. I totally agree with you that Kaiser tells us that what we apply is the ordinary tools of interpretation. And of course, history and purpose and title and all sorts of other things can be indicators of meaning in certain situations. It's also the case, as Justice Kagan recognized in Kaiser, that when the interpretive inquiry stops at the plain meaning of the language on the page, you don't need to go any further. History, unexpressed purpose, those are types of things that can reveal meaning where there's doubt. But of course, you can always stop at the plain meaning. But as it pertains to the history, I don't necessarily agree with the government's description of the history here. If you look at page 9 of our brief, we've listed the first iteration of this commentary. First, the guideline text did not include inchoate offenses explicitly or unambiguously. It has always put them in the commentary. And in fact, if you look at that—
The earlier iterations don't say and similar offenses?
It does, but—
And an inchoate offense is not similar to the underlying offense?
That is what the first commentary said.
No, I'm just asking, isn't conspiracy to distribute drugs similar to—
Yes, if we had—
Distribution of drugs.
If we had catch-all today, I wouldn't be making my argument.
Are you saying aiding and abetting is not included?
Judge Jones, that's a different issue than whether or not attempts and conspiracies are included.
Well, it's certainly within your claim that prohibit doesn't include.
I disagree, and I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why we think aiding and abetting might, in a case where that issue is raised, be something you would read into this text, but why attempts and conspiracies are not. And the reason is aiding and abetting is something that is part of the actual substantive completed offense.
I agree with that.
The Supreme Court told us that in Gonzalez versus Duenas.
And what do we do with two things? Number one, that the overriding purpose of the guidelines is to attribute culpability and therefore imprisonment to similar types of crimes. You cannot give us a principled distinction why conspiracy or attempt are different from the actual drug crimes. Possession is obviously separate, not only because the Supreme Court said it, but because there's this hoary notion, totally unfounded out there, that federal drug crimes are based solely on possession. They're not. They are routinely charged all together or in separate counts, and then they're pled out as one or another. So inchoate crimes and the actual crimes are functionally similar. And of course, number two, there's the fact that Congress specifically approved this commentary, which I know Judge Pryor said, well, we're not to consider that under Stinson, but it seems to me meaningful in this context that Congress did in fact approve this commentary involving inchoate crimes, drug crimes.
There's a lot in there, Judge Jones, but I will try to get to both of your concerns. First, when it comes to purpose, I'm not standing here before you telling you that the Sentencing Commission didn't want to treat attempts and conspiracies as equivalent of completed offenses since the beginning of this commentary. The problem is it's always separated it. It's always used the actual text of the guideline that it has the authority under the Sentencing Reform Act to promulgate to only catch the completed offenses, and it's always only used the informal commentary to catch it. And so the purpose point you make is a good policy point, and it's one that the Sentencing Commission will have to reevaluate and is in fact reevaluating right now. But I do want to stress that in this situation, it does feel a little bit like form over substance. I understand that, but what the Supreme Court made clear in Stinson and in Kaiser and this entire deference doctrine is that the form is the substance, right? When an agency decides, when we're surrendering some of the judicial power to an agency to decide what its rules are, they have to cut square corners, right? And so—
Well, we do, except for the fact that ultimately judges don't even have to follow the guidelines. That is sort of which is partly why the Supreme Court recognized in Stinson that you know, the commission isn't just your ordinary agency.
You're right, Judge Jones, and it goes back further than Stinson. Ms. Strata recognized that the United States Sentencing Commission is unique, but it is not unique in the sense of its rulemaking authority. Its rulemaking authority is exactly the same as all rulemaking. That's one of the reasons the guidelines and the commission's placement in the judiciary is constitutional, because rulemaking is rulemaking. We're talking about rulemaking.
Let me ask you about did I talk over somebody? I'm sorry. thank you, Judge Wilson. What do you make of Stinson, where it says the best analog is executive branch agency interpretations of their own regulations, but it is just an analogy. One of the things it says, amended commentary is binding. This is Stinson. Amended commentary is binding on the federal courts even though it is not reviewed by Congress. Well, factually, that is incorrect here, as Judge Jones has already pointed out. Chief Judge Pryor informed all of us, and some of my colleagues may have known that already, that this did go through Congress. So it seems to me the analogy breaks down with this particular commentary.
Judge Southwick, that's an important question. I'm glad you brought it up, because I did want to get back to Judge Jones' point about—
Well, I think it fits into Judge Jones' point about all this, but that's for you to decide. Go ahead. But I was trying to add that to your explanation.
Thank you. And first, I do want to say, obviously, Stinson is binding, and so this court doesn't have the ability to, you know, depart from its analogy.
I'm
here to defend the analogy.
The premise for Stinson, for unapproved commentary, and this is approved commentary.
Judge Southwick, that is not a correct characterization of the whole thing, the reason why the analogy is apt, right? It's true that the court noted in a different section of the opinion that Congress doesn't review, but in the portion of the opinion where the court made its holding, it relied specifically on the fact that the functional purpose the commission uses the commentary for. It said the word functional purpose, and then it said the word function in those two critical paragraphs as the reason why we treat the commentary like a guideline. It didn't rely on congressional review at all. And let me give you an example. The Congressional Review Act didn't even require agency regulations to go through congressional review until 1996. The APA wasn't even a thing until 1946, a year after Simrel Rock. So we know that what makes a regulation isn't the fact that it goes through notice and comment, and what makes a regulation isn't the fact that it's reviewed by Congress. Those two regulations existed before those
two
requirements did.
In your interpretation, people can raise claims against the federal rules of civil or criminal procedure on the basis of Kaiser, is that correct?
I'm not exactly sure what the mechanism for raising those claims.
Well, because a lot of those rules have the advisory commentary of the advisory committee. And I'm thinking in particular of discovery. I'm thinking in particular of one that we debated a year or two ago, Rule 4K2 on Foreign Service of Process. There are extensive advisory committee notes. And traditionally, the courts have taken those very seriously.
That's totally right, Judge Jones. Now, I think I have a good answer to
you. I'll bet it's not long until clever public defenders find a way to challenge the federal criminal rules. Has that been thought about?
It is something I've thought about, but I don't think that it's a very big problem. And the reason is that, one, the advisory commentary is not entitled to that. In fact, if you look at Stinson itself, Stinson rejected the
analogy. You're saying the advisory commentary in the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure is not entitled to deference. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying it's not entitled to Seminole Rock controlling deference. It is in, of course it is.
Even though the courts, won't you agree that generally speaking in matters of rules of procedure, the courts take those as, you know, biblical?
Biblical, it depends on what we mean by biblical, but yes, look, it is not a question that that is a contemporaneous statement of the court's intent in enacting those rules.
You think the Supreme Court in Kaiser contemplated that possibility when it especially said that we're not saying we're going to upend every kind of rulemaking?
I do think that the Supreme Court recognized that there was a lot of things the court was weighing. The court was considering doing away with deference altogether, right? And so what the court did was it decided that if we're going to give this power to agencies, we're going to make them speak clearly. And so we will, but your concerns about the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, there's not interpretations as such of those that are just sitting out there where it's the agency. The advisory committee notes are a type of legislative history that gets very serious respect, but that differentiates them from the type of interpretations that the commentary are that we're dealing with here. Stinson expressly rejected.
But you have considered, the public defenders have considered that possibility.
I think we have, but
I... Okay, well, let me go on and ask you one other question, and that is, I'm sorry, but I'm not trying to be rude, but you've already...
Not at all. I'm here to answer questions.
The second sentence of Stinson says, we decide that commentary in the guidelines manual that interprets or explains a guideline is authoritative unless it violates a constitution or a federal statute or is inconsistent with or a plainly erroneous reading of that guideline. How can we say that Kaiser tells us how we have to interpret commentary without implicitly overruling Stinson?
Judge Jones, our entire claim is that Stinson told us what the answer to this is. We're not asking you to overrule Stinson. We're asking you to follow it.
So then we can, well, and I think that's a plausible argument. As Judge Nalbandian put it in the Sixth Circuit, in one of the Sixth Circuit cases,
Hardy.
He could decide that case without referring to Kaiser. So what's the big deal about Kaiser here? If your claim is the prohibit under the dictionary doesn't include inchoate offenses.
Well, the big deal about Kaiser is that it set the benchmark and it is now the governing standard for what it is to afford a Seminole Rock deference. And you quoted the language from the beginning of the Stinson opinion. That language is the exact formulation of the Seminole Rock standard that the court discarded as a caricature of the doctrine in Kaiser. So it's not the case that what the court was doing in Stinson was just adopting that age-old, long-standing administrative rule. And I can point you to the...
And if we cite Kaiser to somehow adumbrate the holding of Stinson, then, according to your argument, why does that not implicitly in Stinson, the 11th Circuit got overruled, and it had to do with the question of serious potential risk of physical harm. And interestingly, at the end of the decision, the court says, we now apply these principles to the amendment, which had to do with felon in possession. And it said, we recognize that the exclusion of felon in possession from the definition of crime and violence may not be compelled by the guideline text. Nonetheless, it does not run afoul. Well, you know, it's only subsequent jurisprudence that has told us other things about that, but that holding necessarily implies that felon in possession could have been within the compass of a crime of violence at that point, correct?
Right, and that's because the court applied the lower...
But crime of violence is real open-ended, and that...
Right. I mean, look, imagine the commission had a guideline that just said it's we're going to enhance the sentence if you've got a prior crime of violence, and then they didn't tell us what crime of violence meant. We'd be left with the ordinary meaning of those terms, and I mean, if I don't think a defendant would be heard to say that murder can't fall within the definition of plain meaning of crime of violence, but perhaps if somebody had a jaywalking conviction, that wouldn't count.
Well, if
we
you
would
ask,
just do interpretation.
But if you ask the man on the street whether... when Mr. Vargas conspired to deliver over 5 pounds of kilos of cocaine, he was committing a drug crime, the man on the street would say, duh.
I agree. I would say duh as well. But that's the question here isn't whether the man on the street would recognize this to be culpable conduct. The fact that he was convicted in the past demonstrates that fact. He was punished for that crime. What we're asking is whether or not it's the... something that should change the benchmark for the district court's discretion in deciding how to put a sentence within the statutory range. And so what the Sentencing Commission has told us is the benchmark for, or is the definition that controls in order to sweep those things in, is a definition that does not include conspiracy.
Let me just put a finer point on what Judge Jones just said. If I told Mr. Vargas or you or my son, I prohibit you from distributing cocaine, and my son conspired to distribute cocaine, and I caught him, and he said, I haven't violated what you said, Dad. I only conspired to distribute the cocaine. Why is that not an intellectually defensible interpretation?
I agree with that construction, but you're missing several words from this actual text that we have.
I like prohibit you.
Means. Right? It's an exhaustive list. We're talking about controlled substance offense means. Burgess tells
us. Son, my rule to you means you are prohibited from distributing cocaine.
A
normal person would imagine that conspiring or attempting falls within that.
I don't agree with that, Judge Duncan. I think that the plain meaning of the word prohibit, the ordinary meaning of the word prohibit, is to prescribe. What you've done when you've told your son not to distribute drugs is you forbade them to do that, but you haven't hindered them from doing it. You haven't prevented them from doing it. And so that, but what we're talking about here, the other thing about your example, which I'm prepared to accept in the colloquial sense, right? I don't want to sit here and be unreasonable and fight against that. The other context you're missing with that is we're talking about already sustained convictions for offenses that are doing the prohibiting, right? And so it's an offense that's doing the prohibiting in this particular language. And offenses prohibit specific things. And we know what the commission has delineated are the specific things: distributing, manufacturing, dispensing, possession with intent to do those things. But none of those things include the elements of conspiracy or the elements of attempt. And that's why there's a difference here, and that's why all of these courts have recognized that the plain meaning of this text doesn't include conspiracies, just like it doesn't include possession, it doesn't include solicitation.
Counsel, you alluded...
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
But you alluded to the proposed amendments to the guidelines. Mm-hmm. So do those help you? Do they hurt you? Or do we make nothing of them because they're just proposed? I mean, clearly they're going to resolve this ambiguity if the rules or the commentary is approved, the revised guideline, I should say. So what does that do to our case here?
Well, it doesn't change anything about our case, right?
Our interpretation of the commentary, the guideline, as it currently is.
Well, it would, I mean, courts are loath to give, you know, remedial measures and, you know, post-enactment history, a kind of controlling weight in the interpretive inquiry. I think that what you would say about that is I tend to think that it shows that the commission recognizes what it has always recognized, that it wasn't interpreting the word prohibits, whenever it listed the inchoate commentary, it was just separating those separate concepts.
If there's ambiguity, genuine ambiguity, under, say we're applying Kaiser, do you lose? In other words, if we go farther than plain text and there's no ambiguity and we engage in the Kaiser analysis, don't you lose that?
I suppose, but to do that, you would have to say that it's reasonable to interpret the word prohibits to mean something that there's no actual example of it having that meaning in the wild. The government hasn't been able to point you to any situation in which the words offense and prior conviction and under state law are used with the meaning of prohibit. They give that term. So, but yes, if it was genuinely ambiguous, you would go to those other indicators, and I think we're prepared to say that we would not be able to prevail there. But this is not genuine ambiguity, Judge Wilson. This is clear text, and five courts have recognized that, and we think this court should do the same.
Counsel, I have two quick questions, both related to Judge Wilson's questions. There's no reason that we should wait for November to come around, because it's not going to affect this case, because it would be ex post facto and all of that, right?
Correct.
Second, does the rule of lenity have any role to play if it's not plain? Would we shift instead from all those factors to the rule of lenity?
May I amend my answer to Judge Wilson? I think I will say that the rule of lenity is an option. Right, and the amicus has talked about the rule of lenity in this case. It is a open question in the federal courts. The Federal Circuit has grappled with where the veterans canon, which is a similar canon of interpretation, fits in with Chevron and even this Kaiser deference. In Cargill versus Garland, this court obviously just reinforced that lenity is a canon of interpretation that is very important.
And Cargill was about the question of liability. This is a question of sentencing. Is there any example of using lenity for sentencing rather than liability?
I do, and the reason is because, and I understand you to be referring maybe to Beckles there, right? And obviously the guidelines aren't talking about regulating conduct, but the rule of lenity is different than vagueness doctrine, because what it is it's a canon of interpretation. It's telling us how to figure out what.
Right, but it's a canon of interpretation to tell us that the citizen wants to know, if I do X, am I breaking the law? Here, we know what the law is. You're not allowed to conspire. The only question is the consequence. Do we apply lenity to the consequence or just the liability question?
We apply it to the text. It's a canon of construction, right? It's not something that we're going to be lenient because...
We don't apply it to all text. We don't apply it to civil statutes. We don't apply it to all... That's my question. Does it apply only to liability statutes, or does it apply also to sentencing provisions?
I believe it applies in the criminal context and also in places where there's maybe forfeitures and fines. Justice Gorsuch has certainly argued that much in his concurring opinion in Woodard versus United States last year, that lenity should be extended to things like fines and everything else. But I just want to focus us back here. All I'm saying is that it's an interpretive canon, and so it has to come in somewhere when we're talking about the interpretive toolkit. We would obviously favor the reasonable doubt version of lenity. There's the grievous ambiguity version out there, but we don't think this case requires the court to make that determination, because you're not dealing with two equally plausible constructions of this text. You're dealing with clear language that at the minimum, our reading is the best reading, because it's the ordinary meaning of the term prohibits. And for these reasons, this court should reverse.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Audrey Maness for the United States. This court should affirm. When Andres Vargas tried to purchase 5 kilograms of cocaine from an undercover officer, he committed his third controlled substance offense, qualifying him as a career offender under the United States sentencing guidelines. We know this because the text, structure, purpose, and history of the guidelines tell us so. And they have done so for over 3 decades. Let me be clear on the government's position. The clarifying instructions in Kaiser versus Wilkie apply to the United States sentencing guidelines. Under a proper application of Kaiser, Mr. Vargas's drug trafficking conspiracy is a controlled substance offense, and it is unambiguously so under career guideline, the career offender guideline section 4B1.1 and 1.2. If for whatever reason this court decides that Kaiser does not apply, then the landscape is unchanged. Stinson continues to apply, and the commentary is deserving of deference.
Ms. Manis, you waived uninterrupted time?
I did, Your Honor, yes.
Well, thank you. Sorry to interrupt, but please. Here I am. Your first point, you said the government's position is that Kaiser does apply to the commission. Is that unambiguous, to use word much in play today? Or is there really an argument that you could structure that it's not a clean fit when we're looking at Kaiser?
Certainly, Your Honor, there is an argument that it is not a clean fit. The Sentencing Commission is a unique agency or commission. It is in the judicial branch, not in the executive branch. The guidelines are now advisory, which makes them somewhat differently situated than administrative rules. And so there are a number of factors, as recently explained in Judge Luck's dissent in Dupree, why Stinson may continue to apply and Kaiser does not affect the guidelines at all.
But is Stinson the principal barrier to making that argument?
I don't understand your question, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
Why don't you keep going and see if I can rephrase it.
Okay, thank you. However, it is the government's position, and it is taking this in several oppositions to certiorari and is taking it in this case that Kaiser does apply. There is enough similarity between the guidelines and agency rules and the commentary and agency interpretations. And of course, then we have Kaiser's footnote 3 that acknowledges that Stinson was among the legion of cases that have applied Seminole Rock deference. Let me talk about those.
Counsel, before you do that, you mentioned the dissent, the 11th Circuit dissent. What do you think is the most critical error in both the majority opinion, I believe by Judge, the majority opinion and the concurring opinion, both Pryor, Jill Pryor and William Pryor?
Your Honor, so the critical error in the majority opinion is that it failed to, it considered the text and the text alone. It failed to consider the structure, history, and purpose of the guidelines. And Kaiser directs courts to consider those, I read it as a direction equally across the board, text, structure, history, and purpose. All four of those factors should be considered, and no court of appeals has done that fully yet. This court has the opportunity to do so. In the concurring opinion that held that Stinson applies, but that the commentary was conflicting, I think, again, it reads the text of the guideline too narrowly, but it also doesn't honor the way that Stinson looked at inconsistency. Stinson took a very clear view of inconsistency, such that it's only inconsistent if following the dictates of one results in violating the dictates of another. And that's not the case here. You can follow the text of the career offender guideline and follow the commentary, and there is no conflict between the two.
But four circuits have held just under Stinson, and then also the concurrence here that we were just talking about, that you shouldn't defer. Can you address that?
Yes, Your Honor. And several of those circuits are similarly situated to the panel opinion here, which is there is binding precedent, and that Kaiser does not unequivocally overrule or abrogate that prior precedent.
Right, but even without Kaiser, that there should be no deference.
I see, Your Honor.
The defendant's position is that the public defender's position is that they win either way.
Yes, Your Honor.
So can you address why you would win under Stinson if it's true that you shouldn't defer under the reading of Stinson that four of our circuits plus another concurring judge have articulated?
So we win under Stinson because the guideline that describes laws that prohibit import, export, dispensing, distribution, that language includes laws that hinder export, import, distribution, dispensing, etc.
If we don't buy that definition, though, I mean, conspiracy is not in the guideline, correct?
Conspiracy is in the guideline, in the language with the word prohibits. The guideline encompasses...
If we say that prohibits means anything that hinders, anything that... I guess you have to stretch that a little bit, don't you?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think Dick...
Why didn't they just mention it? They could state it, as they proposed to do in their amendments.
There's a number of ways to include it. They could have stated conspiracy, attempt, and aiding and abetting. They could have said inchoate offenses. They could have said complete or incomplete drug offenses. And they could have said laws that prohibit the manufacture, import, export, and distribution of controlled substances, which is what they did here. There's not one way to include inchoate offenses. There is one of several, and that is what the commission did here. And we know they did that. If you look at the history of this guideline, they've done it from the very beginning. In the original text, they listed a number of federal statutes, and they said, and similar offenses.
Does it matter? I mean, here the commission, even though it wasn't required to, it noticed this inchoate offense, the commentary. It noticed it to the public. It submitted it to Congress. What interpretive weight, if any, does that merit?
I think it plays in two parts of the Kaiser inquiry. First, it plays into the history of this guideline, certainly. That commentary was first submitted just a couple of months after the guideline itself was submitted, and the commission said that it was adding the commentary as part of a broader effort to enhance understanding and clarity without making substantive changes. So here's the commission saying, hey, just in case there's some question, here's some commentary to make things clear. So it's describing what similar offenses were. And then 10 other times the commission has done this, where it has put the commentary forward for notice and comment and has submitted it to Congress without substantive discussion, without objection. And there have been times, like in 1995, when it was submitted to Congress, and Congress rejected certain amendments to the commentary, but it let this commentary pass through without objection. So I do think that plays a role in considering the history of the guideline. I also think the purpose of the guidelines generally should play a role here, and Kaiser tells us it should. We need to look at the implementing statute, 28 U.S.C. 994, and I think Judge Jones acknowledged this when my colleague Mr. House was up, is that the guidelines' goal is to promote certainty and fairness in sentencing and avoid unwarranted sentencing disparities. It says that not only in 991B, but again in 994, and there's a very much an emphasis on we need to treat similar offenses similarly. How do we know what are similar offenses? We can look at how Congress has treated conspiracy, attempt, and aiding and abetting. If you look at 21 U.S.C. 846, what does it say? It says that conspiracy and attempt should be punished exactly the same as the substantive offense.
What is the government's position of whether the new guideline would be applicable? If it passes in November, it would rely on an ex post facto argument, the other side, that it wasn't applicable. But if your argument said it was applicable the whole time, how does that play?
Well, Your Honor, I think it depends on what this court decides, of course.
Right, but if we waited for any, just assume argumento. I'm not saying we, not foreshadowing at all. Just
certainly. I don't think it's appropriate to necessarily wait for the commission. There's no certainty that I know this is a priority, and the amended language, there are two versions of the amended language that are now out for notice and comment. They came out earlier this month. So that needs to go through that period and then be submitted to Congress, of course, so it may not get resolved this calendar year.
Hypothetically, that it were going to be resolved and it was going to be very clear that crimes were included in the new version. What say you about ex post facto and whether the new rule would apply?
Well, the government's position would be that those offenses, Inchoate offenses, were always included, and that, that
so we could apply the new rule instead of the old rule.
We would argue that you would apply the rule, which is Inchoate offenses are included.
You'd apply Lightborn.
Yes.
Light.
Yes, absolutely.
What do you do with lenity?
I don't think you need to reach lenity.
If it's ambiguous as to whether prohibit includes these inchoate things, which assume arguendo that you're right, but it's ambiguous.
If it is ambiguous, then you go to step two of Kaiser. You do not go to lenity.
And why not?
I think
why isn't that in the toolbox?
Because lenity applies only after considering, and this is right from United States versus Castleman, only after considering text, structure, history, and purpose, that sounds familiar, there remains a grievous ambiguity or uncertainty in the statute such that the court must simply guess as to what Congress or the implementing issuing body intended. Right? We don't have to guess here because we go to Kaiser step two. Is the commission's interpretation.
So it's not grievous. It's ambiguous, but not grievous.
Yes, Your Honor. That would be, I would agree with that.
That's what, you think it is ambiguous?
I do not think it's ambiguous. If you reach that step, we think
in
it.
In a hypo, you would say it was not grievously ambiguous, even though multiple circuits have held to the contrary, that it was actually plain meaning the other way.
The guideline unambiguously includes inchoate offenses. If there is some question, it is not grievous ambiguity, but if there is some question, then the court asks, is the commission's interpretation reasonable? And it absolutely is here. It is supported by those same things, text, structure, history, and purpose. And then, of course, it is the commission's official position. I don't think there's any dispute on prong three of Kaiser. Is it of the character and nature deserving of deference? Commentary is official. This commentary in particular has been around for three decades.
Ms. Madness, could I ask you, your friend on the other side said to interpret prohibit in this way would be, he's going to think this is not really what I said, but something along the lines of a unique way to interpret, to have it, to give it this sort of meaning that leads to hinder and anything that hinders. That's not what the 11th Circuit was concerned about. Jill Pryor wrote that it would become unlimited. I don't think she included jaywalking, but loitering, I think she said, and whatever else. Respond to that.
Sure. I think there's a common sense argument that the end goal, that the goal is to stymie drug trafficking. So is the end goal of the crime we are looking at drug trafficking? Conspiracy? Yes. Aiding and abetting? Absolutely yes. Attempt? Yes. Loitering? Maybe 1 in 100 cases. Money laundering? Maybe 1 in 10 cases. Those fall outside. That is informed by, again, the structure, history, and purpose. And
but who draws that line? I mean, you just drew it, but I mean, it seems very faint to me.
I don't think so, Your Honor, and I think the court, not this court, but the Supreme Court has been able to draw that line in the context of the First Amendment. Congress shall pass no law prohibiting the free exercise of religion.
In 30 years, has any court applied, has the government asked any court to apply this guideline to loitering or money laundering?
No, Your Honor, they have not.
Of course not. And in fact, there's a stark difference. The money laundering guides are much, from my perspective at least, are much more stringent than the drug guidelines.
Yes.
It ain't gonna happen if it makes no sense.
I agree, and that's that common sense argument. And there is, to respond to Judge Wilson's question, there is a way to draw the line. It's been done in that First Amendment context. And in fact, in the case of Fulton versus City of Philadelphia, in Justice Alito's concurrence, he relied on dictionary definitions of prohibits to mean both to forbid and to hinder, and said that was the natural reading in the Constitution. So
well, that's, to me, that's key. That it's hindrance is one thing, forbidding is another. And in this context, it seems the most natural reading of prohibit is to forbid. We forbid you to conspire to distribute possess with intent to distribute.
I disagree, Your Honor, and
you do?
I point to Judge Duncan's hypothetical, which is when you instruct somebody, I prohibit you from doing something, you are both forbidding them from reaching the ultimate end goal, but from taking substantial steps towards that goal, from planning towards that goal. And dictionary definitions support both the narrow definition that you just gave and the broader definition in Judge Duncan's hypothetical. And that's why, again, we have to look to structure, history, and purpose, and certainly those support the broader reading in this case.
Let me ask you, a couple other courts have already, several other courts have gone with Kaiser, and one of them used Kaiser to overturn the intended loss section commentary in regard to loss in financial crimes. And another one overturned the $500 minimum on credit card. Now, I agree with Judge Nalbandian that that would have had a hard time being sustained under Stinson. But take just the question about loss. How many other guidelines are at risk with the Kaiser approach here?
If this court adopts a faithful application of Kaiser, that includes not only looking at the text, but also the structure, history, and purpose, I think the guidelines are largely safe. However, if the court takes the approach, unfortunately, that the Third Circuit took in Nasir, a very hypertextualist reading where they didn't even acknowledge the history and purpose of the guidelines generally or the career offender guidelines specifically, every guideline is up for grabs. It's going to be you will see a lot of litigation over this. And you've seen it in the Third Circuit. There's been half a dozen cases already, as you noted, Judge Jones, that are revisiting various guideline provisions.
I'm getting back to your point about history, that the different iterations of the definition of controlled substance offense previously included in co-ed offenses. I'm having trouble understanding a theory that all of a sudden the commission decided to slightly alter the wording and then to, in order to exclude inchoate offenses, which is, I think, what the other side is asking for courts to do. I don't even understand the theory. I haven't heard a theory for why the commission would have done that. Surely there'd be some evidence, some commentary, some explanation, hey, we're making a change in this decades-old interpretation. Do you have any, can you enlighten me on that?
I am not aware of any theory, Judge Duncan, and I think the clear reading of the history here is that the commission, from the very beginning, always intended that it's the language of the career offender guideline and the definition of controlled substance offense include inchoate offenses. And when it has made changes, it continues to include inchoate offenses, whether it's through the and similar offenses that we first saw or through the language, the word prohibits, being read broadly. That I am not aware of any evidence of the commission, an intent from the commission to exclude inchoate offenses.
And it didn't go to Congress and say, here's what our plan is to exclude, because we don't think the conspirators to distribute the cocaine really have committed controlled substance offenses.
Correct. They have never gone to Congress and said that.
No one's making the argument, I take it, that this proposed amendment is a clarifying amendment as opposed to an actual amendment. There's a whole body of law, I'm sure you're aware, of if an amendment's clarifying or not. That's not been briefed here, has it?
No, that has not been briefed. If you're talking about the amendment that is up for notice and comment right now, the commission has not made a statement one way or the other whether it'd be clarifying or substantive. It has acknowledged the circuit split and has proposed two different versions of language, and then it has asked a question for public comment, should we remove inchoate offenses entirely, which again suggests that they have always included inchoate offenses.
That amendment doesn't pass or takes time to pass, and the government persists in its opposition to cert, which it's done three times. Do you agree that the consequence of that is that persons that have conspiracy convictions are sentenced to career offender stat prison time differently around the country?
Yes.
Consequence of the government's continued opposition and assurance to the Supreme Court that the commission may resolve this means that at the moment, similarly convicted persons are serving different prison time.
Yes, there are there are going to be sentencing disparities around the country. But a proper application of Kaiser would be the right result here.
And yet the SG is not urging that as to circuits that haven't properly applied Kaiser.
No, the SG has recognized the Supreme Court's position, which is generally the court leaves disputes relating to the guidelines up to the commission to resolve, and it said so in Braxton and other cases.
And a similar, just clarifying question, am I right or am I wrong that the only issue in this case implicating 4B1.2 in this controversy is his predicate conviction, that his instant offense, because he has a factual basis to the dismiss count two, that qualifies for career offender status regardless of the commentary as relevant conduct?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think he has his two predicate offenses are possession with intent to distribute amphetamines, which is qualifies. Nobody disputes that. There is a conspiracy.
Great conspiracy doesn't count depending on how we resolve.
That's the defendant's argument.
Instant offense.
The instant one is also a conspiracy.
But he pled to a factual basis that was the undercover cocaine buy. He pled to it. How is that not relevant conduct?
His conviction, which is what the guideline talks about, is for conspiracy.
Guidelines incorporate, unless I'm wrong, relevant conduct.
They do, Your Honor, yes. But if we were talking about the career offender guideline specifically, I think we need to look at the conviction of record, which is conspiracy. And I know Mr. Vargas has taken the position that it is not a qualifying offense, and the government has acknowledged that is the argument.
Wouldn't you agree that one easy way for the government to evade an adverse ruling about prohibit, if it doesn't include inchoate offenses, is just to charge the underlying offense in most cases?
Insist
on a guilty plea for the underlying offense.
Certainly, that would be goal if the government receives an adverse ruling before in front of this court.
And so that completely undermines the quest for uniformity and treating similar misconduct alike, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yes, it does. And it is yet another reason why we look at how are conspiracies, attempts, and aiding and abetting treated. They're treated exactly the same as the substantive offense when we're talking about drug trafficking. I know aiding and abetting did come up when Mr. Howes was up here, and I agree with him that is, to the extent the court rules in favor of Mr. Vargas, aiding and abetting is a unique situation.
That's in co-aid too, isn't it?
It is. However, the offense of conviction in an aiding and abetting case is actually the underlying offense. This court has said that in United States versus Rabban and in other cases, that the defendant is guilty through the aiding and abetting statute, section 2, of the actual underlying offense, 21 U.S.C. 841. So underscoring the point that these are all offenses court has treated similarly.
So counsel, that means that the word prohibit obviously includes aiding and abetting someone.
Absolutely. I agree with you completely, Judge Duncan. Yes. And that would be quite an anomalous result to end up with the word prohibiting, including aiding and abetting, but not including conspiracy and attempt. A faithful application of Kaiser here honors the Supreme Court's opinion in Stinson, and it honors the text structure, history, and purpose of the guidelines. It also demonstrates that conspiracies like Vargas's, as well as attempts in aiding and abetting, are controlled substances under Section 4B1.2. The district court got it right when it sentenced Vargas as a career offender, and this court should affirm. If there are no further questions, I'll yield the rest of my time. Thank you.
I have a couple points to make on rebuttal, Your Honors. I think I'll start, Judge Duncan, with the point you just made about it is not the word prohibit that includes aiding and abetting in this language. It is the mere enumeration of the completed offenses. Gonzalez versus Duenas-Alvarez tells us when we're dealing with...
Are there really an enumeration of completed offenses? It's just, they're verbs. Well, they're nouns.
Oh, you're right. They're
manufacture, import, export. If Congress had wanted to enumerate offenses, it could have done so as it did in prior versions of the definition.
Sure. To be very technical, you're right. What they're enumerating is elements of an offense. And elements...
It doesn't use the term elements. The one above it uses the term elements, but this one doesn't.
The context tells us we are dealing with elements because this is the categorical approach.
Really? If Congress had wanted to say elements, it would have used the word elements, which it did in the definition right above it.
Judge Duncan, that's not a correct restatement of the law. The law as it is right now is when Congress, or as we're talking about here, the Sentencing Commission, uses the word conviction, that implicates the crime or the categorical approach. We're the overall context here, and that's why...
I just meant the definition of crime of violence in 4B1.2A uses the term elements.
That's true, but that's because it's talking about a specific element there. Look, my argument doesn't rely on whether or not you think this is a list of offenses or a list of elements. The Supreme Court has told us this is a list to some extent. It doesn't list possession, and that is not included. That is specifically excluded, and this court did, this very court did affirm an enhancement based on mere possession in 2006, and the Supreme Court said summarily that was wrong, and other courts were doing it too. It's not just this court that had that wrong, and I understand the instinct to want to look at this and say this is a list, those things are like the list, but the main problem here is that the commission has chosen the way to enumerate these things, and it has separated attempt and conspiracy, and I did want to make this point. The Supreme Court told us in 1899 in Keck versus United States that when we're talking in the context of offenses, attempt and conspiracy are different. So when you tell your son not to distribute drugs, that's different than saying my son was convicted of an offense to distribute drugs. If you said that, you would not be saying, and you could not be saying, that he was convicted of offense to conspire to distribute drugs. And
the amicus brief in this case, which I know you've read, it argues that increasing criminal sentences based on the guidelines commentary is not just unwise, but unconstitutional. Do you agree with that?
We are not strictly taking a position on that. We are not urging that contention here. That view is a separate view of lenity that is more robust than what I understand the Supreme Court to have relied on before, whereas I was discussing earlier, the Supreme Court was uses lenity as a background, almost clear statement rule in the criminal context as a canon of construction. It is certainly, I think, relevant. The reason why that rule exists is something, you know, furthers that policy statement the amicus has recognized, and that we should strictly construe statutes because, after all, liberty is on the line, and Judge Bibas in the Third Circuit has, you know...
Well, sentencing is not on the line in the same way that the fair notice of the fundamental criminal conduct is on the line, as you know. But anyway, what other provisions of the guidelines off the top of your head, in addition to the ones that courts have already allegedly dealt with under Kaiser, are at risk?
Well,
because of commentary.
Judge Jones, the only provisions that are at risk are the ones that the commission might decide. I mean, the commission has the tools to, as Chief Judge...
I'm just asking you, yes, but the commission isn't going to take them all up at once and review the entire two volumes, okay? So what ones are the public defenders thinking are vulnerable?
Certainly, we've raised the argument that you mentioned in the Third Circuit case about intended loss. There's arguments on both sides of those. We would obviously advocate the position that...
Just give me your position. What, name some of the guidelines.
I actually don't have a list for you, Judge Jones. I mean, I haven't gone through and looked to see which ones. And I mean, I think that's because a lot of the guidelines do employ ambiguity or do... you know, list a term in the text and then put the entire definition in the commentary. And so there's nothing going to be the only...
About terms of supervised release, we've had a lot of cases about those lately. I guess you could go to town on those, huh?
We could go to town on any guideline that doesn't, or any commentary that doesn't reasonably interpret the text in the guideline. That's the only thing we're talking about here, is where a court would read the text and think that the commentary is not a reasonable interpretation of it.
Could I ask one more question? If I overhear.
Sorry, Judge.
If I agree with you that there is no ambiguity in 4B1.2, the guideline, but I'm not convinced that Stinson isn't still binding on us, how is the commentary inconsistent when it's just adding inchoate crimes? If I see the commentary as just additive, it wouldn't be inconsistent under Stinson, even if it wouldn't get Kaiser deference. You see my thinking?
I understand the question, Judge Higginson. I think that to say that it is adding is to say that it is inconsistent, and that's what the Fourth Circuit recognized in Campbell, because what you're saying there is that we have a definition that's complete in the text, and that another definition is adding to it. So that is, by its nature, inconsistent to be adding to it, right? And so it would have to be through this use to prohibit. If you'll allow me, I would like to just give a direct answer to Judge Elrod about the ex post facto, because that is important. The time of the offense governs the ex post facto clause. So Mr. Vargas was convicted, and the guideline, as it presently is constituted, applied. So it would apply to him. But of course, Judge Lake can consider the proposed amendment under 3553A remand as a basis for upward variance. And that's another reason why the sky won't fall if you apply Kaiser to the guidelines. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. That will conclude the arguments for today. The court is adjourned until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning.